This is The Guardian.
I'm Barry Cassidy.
And I'm Tony Barry.
Welcome to Back to Back Barry's, a podcast from Guardian Australia. Well, support for One Nation continues to grow exponentially. We can only guess as to whether there is a ceiling and when that might be reached, but now for the first time, polls, two of them, including Redbridge, are showing them with a higher primary vote than the governing Labor Party. So here's the timeline, because I think occasionally it's worth going back and having a look at it. One Nation got 6.4% at the last federal election, just over a year ago, 6.4%. By October, 5 months after that, they were getting 12%. They were challenging the Greens as the third force, and for the first time, they were polling strongly enough to get seats in the House of Representatives. But then they really started to consolidate December last year, January this year, when they were getting numbers like 22% primary vote, which meant they'd overtaken the coalition on the primary vote, but still not by enough to win more seats in the coalition. That happened 2 months ago, late April, early May. And by then, they'd built such a strong level of support that they certainly had the numbers to be the official opposition. And now, in the last 2 or 3 weeks, we see polls that show them outpolling Labor on the primary vote. So their position continues to build. It's feeding on itself. The stronger they're standing in the polls, the more media attention they get, the more the anti-Labor vote jumps on board, persuaded One Nation and not the coalition, Tony, is the better bet for them.
Yeah, I think late last year when One Nation started cannibalising the coalition vote, a lot of my Labor friends were carrying on like Arsenal supporters, and now, of course, the One Nation monster is coming after them. So the question is, though, what is their ceiling? At the moment, it's 31%, which is extraordinary, and Labor are 28% in our polls. The really interesting thing to me was, despite a bad budget reception, coalition vote went back 2 points. So they weren't the beneficiaries of Labor's lost vote share of 3 points, which speaks to how people perceive the coalition, not just in terms of economic management, but just their frustration and this sense of Hanson is their wrecking ball. She's their truth teller. They just want to put a flamethrower through the joint. And we've discussed this before, you know, 15% of voters said burn it all down, you know, in terms of the political system. And 39% said the system needs major change, and One Nation voters were overrepresented in that cohort. So there's a real sense of frustration and despondency out there that is fueling this One Nation vote. But they're still 2 years away from the finish line. And yep. Whether they can last the distance or not, I think is going to be, you know, really interesting.
Yeah, she mentioned Arsenal. Even Arsenal had a ceiling, and that was the Champions League.
Yeah, yeah.
But nevertheless, I think we're using the wrong term anyway with ceiling. I think it's the wall that they're going to hit. And the wall is the wall around the cities. I still can't see any evidence that the One Nation can seriously challenge, apart from the very outer suburbs. If they're going to be true to their base, then the city, I think, is impenetrable to them. You look at the kind of makeup of city seats, and we see this through the research and the demographics, that they're younger, they're better educated, they're multicultural. That is not fertile ground for One Nation. And the more we hear rumblings about abortion and taking away people's abortion rights, and the more we hear about them, Barnaby Joyce has described tax cuts, for example, as rubbish. I just cannot see the day when enough city people take them on.
Yeah, we saw in the MRP there were some metropolitan seats which were in danger of One Nation, and certainly as Labor's primary vote continues to collapse.
But metropolitan or outer suburbs?
Outer suburban, but, you know, One Nation are competitive in those outer urban seats. On our last poll on the primary vote, they'll almost statistical tie in those outer suburban seats. But we come back to the pure mechanics of a campaign. You know, if you've got, say, $20 million to run a campaign, where do you put that $20 million? Campaigns are an allocation of resources. Now, if I was running the One Nation campaign, I'd say all these regional seats in New South Wales, Queensland in particular, Victoria, they're the lower-hanging fruit for us. I would put all my resources into those seats and make sure we win that. And then maybe at the next election, we can sort of look at perhaps expanding the map a bit. The other problem with One Nation over the next 2 years is you know, the abortion issue came up this week. I think that's going to suppress their vote in some demographics and cohorts. And then, you know, Barnaby made a complete mess of it on Thursday night on Sky After Dark. And if ever there was a good half volley, it's on Sky After Dark for someone like Barnaby Joyce. And he put it straight into the net.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because Andrew Bolt's conclusion at the end of all of that was that One Nation are not ready for government when these sort of mistakes are made. But Barnaby Joyce went on the program. They were talking about housing, and Pauline Hanson has a policy that foreigners shouldn't own housing. She'll get a lot of support for that, people living overseas. But he extended it to permanent residents, those who have been accepted to live the rest of their lives in this country. And he said that if they didn't, if they owned houses, they'd take them off them in 2 years if they didn't sell them. You know, it's just, it was extraordinary. And Bolt did make it clear to him, are you talking about permanent residents here? He said, yeah, those who are not citizens, right? And then, of course, he had to go back and straighten that out, because that's, he'd just thrown a bomb into the whole operation. And they are the sorts of things that can happen when Barnaby Joyce, who's really the 2AC within the party, is going to make those mistakes. And it throws it forward to me to candidates. Like, if you're going to win a federal election, you've got to win 76 seats in the House of Representatives. Do you seriously think One Nation can come up with 76 credible candidates around the country when the full glare comes on an election campaign and people do focus on who the candidates are? They know who the candidates are, most of them, enough to make a difference. History shows they can't do it.
Well, arguably they need 150 candidates for the House of Reps. Obviously some seats they've got they'll have no hope in, but you want to harvest votes for the Senate ticket. Because Senate is probably where they will, even if they have some real problems internally and they hit that wall as you describe it, they still stand to win quite a lot in the Senate. So they're going to need candidates in every seat to harvest votes for the Senate. So there's 150. And plus, you're going to need about 30 candidates for the Senate. You're going to at least need to run two candidates for every state, probably three, you know. There's no harm in having three on the ticket. But that's at least 180 candidates with a microphone. I'd be very nervous about that. We know one fellow here in Victoria who's joined One Nation. He has very strong views on abortion, and that's fair enough. He's entitled to his views, but he's not going to want to not articulate those views once given a microphone. Now, maybe that's fine for their vote. Maybe that won't impact their vote, but maybe it will.
Yeah, well, it will in the cities, that vote, and just having total disdain for climate change is another one that just won't work in the cities. But, you know, when we talk about the kind of, you know, we're trying to understand who these people are, and we you know, quite accurately, we say that they're people who feel as if they've been left behind and they're looking for a new home. But it comes down to this issue of that's the politics of grievance. And at one stage, we have to start talking about the politics of solutions. And we saw that at the last election when the coalition settled on, and I think so did the rest of the country. The cost of living was the number one issue, and Labor didn't balk at that. Their response was, well, yes, now who's got the solutions? And the community judged that the coalition did not. And that's where it comes with, I think that's another problem for One Nation. They'll use all of these cultural issues like, you know, the flag and, you know, patriotism and welcome to country and transgender and whatever, when the really big issues in this country are education, health, transport, you know, those kind of issues. So the glare of an election campaign can focus on that and find that they're inadequate. Or they might just hear this cacophony of noise during a campaign. And so I'm sick of a lot of them.
Yep.
And so I'll vote for One Nation. I think it's the responsibility of the major parties to get them focused on the politics of solutions.
But on cost of living, on our most recent track for the AFR that was published last weekend, which had, you know, One Nation ahead 31%, we also asked who's the best to manage cost of living, which is a number one, two or three issue for 76% of the population.
Yeah,
so
I'll bet.
An extraordinary number. Mm. And it was, again, basically a statistical tie between the three parties. 21% said the ALP, 20% said One Nation, and 19% said Coalition. So, like, let that wash over you. Coalition is coming third to One Nation.
But One Nation, when One Nation's response just this week, just take this week, they opposed an increase in the minimum wage for the poorest Australians.
Mm.
They opposed the tax cuts. They called them rubbish. Barnaby Joyce called them rubbish on national television. How then can they, the 20% make, look, by all means, the 20% are pissed off about all sorts of things, but to suggest that One Nation is the vehicle for the grievance,
yeah.
to say that they're the vehicle for the solution when they oppose a wage increase for the lowest paid workers is just nonsensical.
At Ripage, we call the One Nation voters, we call them, you know, blue One Nation or red One Nation, red being former Labor voters turned One Nation. And, you know, COS has made the point a few times, my business partner, that they are very susceptible to messages about Hanson's voting record on wage increases. Sally McManus from the ACTU has done a couple of videos on that. And that does make some of those red One Nation voters pause and hesitate. And that issue this week about the wage rise plays perfectly into that. So, you know, Labor might recover some of that vote with sort of a lot of repetition of that. But Labor are losing the budget conversation. That was the other finding in our polls, was that we asked people, A, how much attention have you paid to it? Around 0.5% self-reporters having paid a lot of attention or somewhat attention. But when we asked them, is it good for you personally and is it good for the country, around half of all voters said, bad for the country, bad for me personally. And what will be worrying Labor strategists is that net minus 8 of Gen Z voters said bad for them personally. So more Gen Z voters said it was bad for them personally than good for them personally. Now, that's, you know, minus 8 is contestable. Yeah. I wouldn't be panicking if I was in Labor headquarters. That means that with a lot more work, you know, we can fix that. And they're certainly doing that at the moment. You can tell they've changed their messaging. Originally, it was sort of, you know, this is addressing generational inequality, which I didn't think landed as a message. They've now, you know, in the last part of the week, they've been changing to this is levelling the playing field. So what that says to me is they've been doing their research in the field, focus groups, and they're finding that these messages weren't landing or persuading voters. But when they're talking about, okay, these new taxes, they're about levelling the playing field, it's probably more persuadable for that cohort.
Yeah, and I think one thing that was overlooked because there was so much attention on the One Nation increasing their vote this time around, that Labor's vote fell from 31 to 28% in the primary vote. That's really low for a government. But also, it comes immediately after the budget. Now, I have been saying for decades, there's really no such thing as a budget bounce. And really, you rarely see a government suffer in the polls because of budgets. They're important in the longer term. Let's face it, they define who you are. But in terms of impacting on the polls, it's very rare. Now you get 3% slump. So I can understand them being concerned, but they keep saying they're ready for it.
Yeah.
And this is what they wanted to do, and this is the time in the political cycle to do it.
Yeah, I'm not sure they were ready for it, but to your point, you're absolutely correct. I mean, the two most popular budgets, according to News Poll, which has been tracking these things for 40 years, the two most popular budgets were the 1996 one, Costello's very first budget when they came in. They had to make some tough decisions and they didn't back away from that. The second most popular budget was the 2007 federal budget, and we lost government, 6 months later. So it doesn't always follow that, you know, a bounce or going backwards is a terminal event.
Or that, or Kevin Rudd's a genius.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, he was
ruthlessly
on message, and he had some very smart people around him, including the campaign director, Tim Gartrell, is now Albanese's chief of staff, so he's no mug. But the other point that I'd make about, you know, when they say they're ready for this, you know, I don't think they did the pre-positioning they needed to do. They'd spent, you know, years actually saying there will be no CGT changes or negative gearing changes. It wasn't necessary. And then suddenly they said, oh, actually it is necessary. Mm-hmm. And I think that has put them at a big disadvantage to articulate that message. When you think back at the GST reform campaign, Howard in May 1997 sort of let the cat out of the bag that, you know, there might need to be a consumption tax at some point. Which was a deviation from his message before the election where he said, you know,
yeah, but I would argue that's what the government did when they called that summit and said everything was on the table in August last year.
Yeah, but then that was in May 1997, and then in August 1997, Howard went on Laurie Oakes, the Sunday Breakfast Show, and announced the great tax reform adventure, and they spent 12 months, almost exactly to the day, 12 months articulating. They had consults.
They did
put out material articulating the case why the system was broken. Yeah. And then they said, "Here's our plan." I think it was August 13. I remember because I was working for Christopher Pine, and that was his birthday. So that sort of ruined his birthday because it's all about Christopher. And and then they called the election at the end of the month for October. So that's an example of where they did all the work. And Howard was, I remember this vividly, you know, he told all these members of parliament, these new members of parliament, because he had 94 seats as well. He said, you know, some of you won't come back. You know, there will be lost seats. And it was like, you know, congratulations on winning your marginal seat and coming into parliament, but, you know, we're promoting you to the front line of Gallipoli. And of course, a lot of them didn't come back. I think we lost about 16, 17 seats. So,
yeah, you know, there's an historical match for that as well, with the Joe for Canberra push, which is kind of like One Nation, except I think One Nation is more sustainable. Joe for Canberra exploded. Joe wasn't even there on the day. But, you know, Queensland backbenchers were coming to me and saying, why isn't Bob Hawke doing more? Why isn't he taking on Joe? And the argument coming to me from others was that, no, leave him alone. He's just destroying the coalition, right? Yeah. So why would you touch him? But these people say, good, fine for you. Mm. And say, yes, but, you know, Labor could end up with a whole lot more seats down south. And you're trying to tell people in Queensland that you're being sacrificed for the good of the party. It's a tough argument to run. And I think the Liberals are now confused about that as well, about, you know, they allowed the Teals to come in and then almost gave them the two-finger salute. And so they lost that kind of moderate, the centre. And now you've got Tony Abbott saying, I don't want to denigrate Pauline Hanson, while they lose the right wing.
That must have been Hawke's favourite year, was it? What was his mood like around the office?
Well, look, there was a little bit of trepidation because on the one hand you wondered, could he really succeed? Mm. Most was persuaded no chance, right? It was a Queensland phenomena that would eventually blow up, and it did. But yeah, they were remarkable times because we'd never seen anything like it. And the reason it doesn't really have a place in history is because nothing came of it. Whereas I think the One Nation rise will certainly, this has been a major transformation.
Yeah, I think there's some serious money behind One Nation. And we've been discussing about this in recent weeks. I'm convinced that One Nation are using a lot of Trump campaign consultants. We know that, you know, there's connections there overseas. But there is some really clever digital media stuff happening with some serious weighted message behind it. Mm. And of course, the problem, you know, these days is it's almost impossible to track. You know, we all live in our own corner of the internet, and it's difficult to sort of track what's out there. It's not like the old days where you'd watch the commercial news and you'd see there'd be an ad on, you know, the first window of the news, and then there'd be an ad, you know, on the main movie that night. And it was on page 3 of the
Those ads were so important that they used to have advertisement launches.
Yeah.
They'd get all the media together and show them their latest ad.
Yeah.
And it would all get a run. Sally McManus, you mentioned before, Ross has sent an email saying he doesn't see this popularity being translated into electoral success. That's One Nation. A week is a long time in politics. 2 years is an eternity. But he says that because they can get hit from the left and the right. And he gave two examples. One was Sally McManus going through One Nation's history of voting against workers' rights. That's one. And the other was James Patterson on the other side, highlighting Hanson's dreadful record at turning up into the parliament. So that's Ross's view. And then there's another one here from Josh that gives you a sense that not all those who are disillusioned with the Liberal Party are turning to One Nation, right? They don't know where to go. And he Josh talks about the very interesting, he said, position of Noah, Noah expressed, who we met at the Writers' Festival. He's a disillusioned young person, confused about where to turn. Josh reminded me that in 2013 I went to De La Salle High School in Melbourne. It's interesting, my grandson goes there now, but anyway, he asked me who I thought would be the best to lead the Liberal Party at the time, and I said Malcolm Turnbull, and 2 years after that he became the leader. Now, Josh said he believed that Malcolm Turnbull was stabbed in the back, and in his opinion, that's when the modern Liberal Party died, and Angus Taylor's attempt to be One Nation Knight feels like another day of the same shit with a different face, is how he expressed it. But the important thing he says is that many of his friends, and now they're well educated, they're lost politically, socially, and economically. Mm. It's really, it's an impactful comment.
Yeah. I think back to the first letter, I think Sally McManus's argument, as I said before, we've tested that and there was strong agreement on a national sample basis. The James Patterson line about 88% not attendance at Senate estimates, I'm not sure that's going to land. That's real Canberra speak. And for a lot of these One Nation voters, they're just, mate, their first question would be, what's a Senate estimates? Most people, when you talk about Senate estimates and focus groups, you know, the name rings a bell. But when you say, well, what is Senate estimates? They got no idea. And to be honest, Barry, you know, sort of, I used to work in the building and I couldn't stand Senate estimates. You know, you'd always get these phone calls from hysterical senators saying, you know, we need questions. And just like, mate, no one's listening. I mean, as you know, some of it gets covered.
Oh, for the insiders, it's fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there was a lot of good stuff this week.
But I mean, I think Hanson's responsible. Yeah, I'm not turning up to that waste of time. I'm out talking to real people and I think people would go, good. So, you know, you've got to show that personal consequence or what is the personal consequence of this? And McManus is doing that. I just think that's insider talk about Senate estimates.
Yeah. Just a couple of things that I want to put to the pollster in you. One is that I think if an election were held today with One Nation on 31 and the government on 28, the government would win perhaps with a majority and One Nation would end up with, be about 20 seats short of government. And they would be saying, how does that work? How do we not win when we're more popular than the Labor Party? And what doesn't get through to them is that they've got big numbers, bigger than 30%, into the 40s in some of the regional and rural seats, more than they need in those places to win seats, but they haven't got the numbers where most of the people live. So it's not an even spread across the board. It doesn't work that way. And trying to explain that to them would be difficult, I think.
Australia is a nation of smaller and smaller tribes. So I think back to the mid-90s when I was involved and sort of what worked in North Queensland in terms of messaging, where I'm from, sort of landed in Brisbane, worked in Melbourne. There was, you know, in the 2000s, this peculiarity in the seat of Melbourne when Lindsay Tanner, a great Labor Member of Parliament and Finance Minister, he was the member there. And the Greens used to get into the double digits in primary vote, which was considered an oddity, but he used to win comfortably. And then, of course, that seat fell, and then a series of others fell, including in Queensland. But we're not a nation of we're a homogenous sort of country anymore where, you know, what works in Queensland works in WA. And that makes it very difficult for parties to appeal to the entire electorate. So they've got a narrow cast, and it's also why we're seeing the rise of the Teals in those inner suburban seats that have a different value structure than in the outer suburbs and similarly again in the regions. So, you know, can any party get over 40% primary again? I'm not convinced about that. I'm more convinced that we're not going to see the coalition with over 40% primary or Labor. As to One Nation's future, I mean, they could climb into the 30s, but they could come right back to the pack into the teens, I think, as well.
I've got one other question for you as a pollster as well. Do you think the two-party preferred calculation is any longer worth doing? When you consider now the how fragmented the political calculus is, that you now have six distinct groups. You have Liberals and Nationals and Labor. You've got the Greens, One Nation and Teals.
Yeah.
Is it any longer of any value doing that calculation?
Yeah, no, you're right. It's not a bad diagnostic test, you know, so we can track how things are travelling nationally and so forth. But you're right. These days, you know, you've almost got to look at inner metropolitan suburbs, whether it be Brisbane, Melbourne, Adelaide, so forth, outer suburban, which is a different cohort again, and the regions. So, and then you've got various differences between the states.
And yet you still have people saying they look at them, they're given the primary votes, and then their question is, yeah, but what does that mean in terms of seats? So how do you then explain to them what it means in terms of seats if you don't use the two-party calculation?
Yeah. I mean, it's a force of habit. But, you know, when I used to work for Mark Texter, one of Australia's, you know, best campaigners, he would only ask what the primary vote was. So when we got the cross tabs in every second Monday morning, you know, that was his first question, what's the primary vote? Then he'd ask some of the lead indicator numbers. He rarely asked what the 2PP was, and that was back then when of the 150 House of Rep seats, about 149 or 148 were Labor-Liberal contests.
Mm. All right, we'll take a break. But when we come back, we'll talk about AUKUS. It's become a real flashpoint now. We know that within the Labor Party, caucus for AUKUS, absolutely caucus for AUKUS, but what about the rest of them? We'll talk about that in a minute.